Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to the College Commons Podcast and a conversation I've been looking forward to with my friend and colleague, Rabbi Jeffrey Marks. Ordained in 1983, Rabbi Jeffrey Marks served as the spiritual leader of the Santa Monica Synagogue from 1985 to 2021. As an independent scholar, he has examined the out-of-the-way chapters of American Jewish history. From his article titled Eating Up, The Origins of Bagels and Lox, to his book Smoothing the Jew, about Jewish self-representation at the turn of the 20th century, designed to counteract the classic ethnic stereotypes. And most recently, Jewish Firebugs, Arson and Antisemitism from the Civil War to World War I, which is coming out in July of 2026 from New York University Press. Jeffrey Marks, my friend, welcome to the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
At the outset, you raise a perennial question, a really troubling one. Do you, Rabbi Jeffrey Marks, want to write about a history that does not merely debunk, but also engages with the reality behind anti-Semitic stereotypes? In fact, you put that problem in the mouths of your parents, to whom you dedicate the book. Where do you, as an historian, run up against you as a member of a vulnerable ethnic minority?
Look, it's always a little fraught. Frankly, when I was working on this book about 5 years ago, the climate in the U.S. was not quite as fraught for Jews as it most recently has been these last couple of years with the huge rise in anti-Semitic incidents. Nonetheless, look, in one sense, we Jews are like everyone else. We look at, especially in the area of my interest of Jewish life at the turn of the 19th century, and the remarkable rise of Jews from being totally poor immigrants to finally making their way in America. It takes a little longer than it's part of the myth, but it eventually does happen. And the question is how and why? And oftentimes we Jews say, oh, it's the Yiddish cup, it's the Jewish head, the Jewish intelligence, we're inborn with it, we're just smarter than everyone else, right? But the fact is that there are real cultural, social, economic factors that helped Jews make it in the world. And that's what I want to investigate. How was it that the Jews made it? And frankly, one of the answers is that some Jews made it through criminal activity. Not just arsonists, rum runners during Prohibition,
sure.
And of course, the awful stuff like Murder Incorporated, etc. We sometimes forget from our vantage point of 100 years later, the Lower East Side was really a slum. It wasn't just a poor neighborhood. Life was really, really tough for immigrants there. And some made the very risky decision that the way that they could better themselves was not by working 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week in a sweatshop. They could take shortcuts. And some did through arson.
So we're going to get to the arson. I want to roll back a bit to the anti-Semitism part of this, the other side of that equation. Probably less surprising than the fact of arson to most of our audience. But you do something interesting. You break down some of the core components that fueled the anti-Semitism in this context in the late 19th, early 20th century. So break down for us the primary forces that fueled accusations of Jewish arson in its raw anti-Semitism before we get to the history of, in fact, Jewish arson.
I think the primary factor going on at the time, and we're sort of living through a replay of this, has to do with immigration. For Americans at the turn of the century, a lot of them were greatly alarmed at the numbers of immigrants that come pouring into America. In 1900, one-third of New York City is made up of new immigrants. Right? That's an extraordinary figure.
And as a result, you're getting pushback from longer-celled Americans who are really worried. They're worried about this unwashed horde of people coming in. How are they going to fit into America? And are they going to take our jobs? And they don't look like us. They don't sound like us. They don't dress like us. There's an enormous amount of worry about this. And that worry gets manifest in all sorts of cultural productions of the time. By the way, not just for Jews. You know, this worry about the Italians. We worry still about the lingering Irish that are there. And as well, you still have the influx of Black Americans moving up from the South into northern cities as well, that's pushing buttons as well. So you have all this anxiety about immigration to begin with. And in some ways, the Jews become, as they put it, the synecdoche for immigration in general and the problems of immigration. There's also, of course, by 1900, a huge change in America as a result of the industrialization that really started full blast in the 1880s. At this point, it's the end of the displacement from the countryside into the cities. We're now in the start of the Gilded Age. People are making money through all sorts of strange things. Stock manipulation and trusts. And for the average American, that old notion of the Protestant work ethic, hard, diligent work will get you success. Somehow there seems to be shortcuts to that process. So you have all those anxieties going on that begin to undermine the fueling of anti-Semitism. And then you have the older anti-Semitic stereotypes going on. You've got the notion of the Jew as the stranger. You have the notion of the Jew as a malevolent force in society who has it in for Christians. You have Americans who have grown up watching the story of Shylock on the stage and reading the Charles Dickens' story of Fagin. We begin to hear stories, and this started to surface during the Civil War, of Jewish clothing manufacturers who were making inferior materials for the Union Army. Right, and making a fortune. So you have all these historic ways of looking at Jews that are already deep anti-Semitic myths that now all come together by the turn of the century.
All right, so now let's get to the history of the kernel of truth, as it were, to some of these stereotypes, or simply more blandly put, the fact of what the record shows on Jewish arson, again, at the latter part of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. Jewish arson, though clearly exaggerated and weaponized because of these anti-Semitic feelings, did to some degree have a place on the landscape of turn-of-the-century American Jewish history. Fundamentally an economic crime, I think it's fair to say, as you put it. It therefore had a business model at its heart. Tell us about the economic structure of arson in America, and give us a specific taste of the economics of arson through the roles of the public adjuster and the fire broker.
Again, let me circle back to underscore that arson is taking place in the midst of great poverty. So here you are, you're renting a apartment in a tenement building. And what do you do when the fire broker comes to visit? The fire broker says to you, listen, I can arrange for you to get a payout from a fire insurance company. He said, we're going to insure the goods that are in your apartment for $800. It will cost you an initial down payment of $2. $2 to insure your goods for $800 worth of damages. Now, here you are again, working in a sweatshop. You're roughly making $8 to $10 a week. You're paying rent of roughly between $20 and $30 a month for your apartment. Okay. As a result of this process, you're going to end up collecting $150. All right. That's 6 months' rent. That's an extraordinary amount of money. So here's what happens. The fire broker says, here's the deal. You're going to give me a percentage of what you get from the insurance company once they pay you out. In return, what I'm going to do is hire a torch. Now, the torch is a professional fire setter. What he's going to do is start a fire one corner of the apartment, And we anticipate the fire department will be there shortly. So the entire building is not going up. Do not worry. But it will be enough to do some damage. Then once the fire has occurred, I'm going to bring in a public adjuster that I know. Now, the public adjuster has excellent English and he knows insurance backwards and forwards, and he will represent you to the fire insurance company when they come knocking on your door at the end. You probably only had $10 worth of stuff that was burned. He is going to inflate it so you get as much money as possible. And in return, you'll give him a little bit of the money that you get from the insurance company. All right. So the day is set. The fire broker says to the inhabitants, okay, do something else for the day. Go get yourself a good alibi. We'll see you later. The torch goes in, sets the fire. And sure enough, the insurance company calls. There's the public adjuster waiting for them. They'll negotiate back and forth. And in the process, neither the public adjuster, who's representing the client, nor the fire broker will end up telling the client how much money they actually got from the fire insurance.
It's a black box.
It sure is. As a result, everyone wins, right? The tenement owners get their payout, enough for 6 months of rent. The fire broker gets his cut. The public adjuster gets his. And the fire broker demands an extra cut from the public adjuster for recommending him to begin with.
Of course.
God. It's a great business. Now, it turns out the only ethnic group, and trust me, there are Italians setting arson as well, and there were Irish, et cetera, but the only group who operated with a cast of characters like this were the Jews.
Ah, which is organized it.
Highly organized it. They did. I hate to say it. Yiddish a cup.
Boy. So one of the clearly anti-Semitic firebrands in the marketplace against the Jews, who did in fact exaggerate and weaponize the fact of Jewish arson against the Jews, tried to use statistical proportions to articulate the point that arson claims were 14% of the claims and Jews were only 8% of the population, whatever. They were trying to establish these correlations whereby the Jews came out as disproportionately involved in the business that you described. Tell us about the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the claims and the use of those numbers. You know, is it real or is it just more lies and statistics? And then tell us about the non-Jewish voices who came to the aid of the Jews who were trying to defend themselves against these slanders.
Mm. All right, let's first start with the numbers that are possible. And it's very, very hard to actually come up with a hardcore figure. First of all, a lot of arson cases never got prosecuted successfully. They couldn't find the torches, et cetera. But all told, over a close to 30-year period, for at least the research I've done, I don't believe there were more than about 200 individuals involved in arson activities, right? That's really small number. If you compare that with the population of New York City, you end up with like 1/10,000th of 1% of New York's population of Jews, right? Nonetheless, especially in the fire insurance business, there was Charles Hein, who was really the patriarch of fire insurance in America, who had strong, if I could put it, nativist credentials, and who was highly anti-Semitic. He was convinced that the Jews were disproportionately involved in setting fire to their businesses. And what he looked at in fire reports were the Jewish names that were reported in the reports or in the newspapers. Now, the issue is, in the fire reports and in the newspapers, they listed all the inhabitants who lived in the building.
Uh-huh. They goose the numbers.
Huge, huge. And of course, you have all sorts of, at times, German-sounding names that are in Jews, et cetera.
A Schneider by any other name.
Exactly, exactly. So by the late 1890s, when Hein presented this at yet another insurance conference, he got a lot of pushback. A lot of the people there said, look, we do know how statistics work, and this is just cranky and anti-Semitic.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
I want to go back to the period before the statistical analysis has some heft that you produced in your book, the period between the Civil War and the major, major influx of Eastern European Jews into metropolitan United States. The actual cases are even fewer and further between. It's really rare, but the stereotype has already begun. And in 1867, before the phenomenon we've been discussing thus far, but with the stereotype already getting traction, the Jewish community, centered in part in Cincinnati and the Hebrewian College, it might be added, gets fed up and fights back with traditional modes of Jewish civil self-defense, by which I mean they muster their economic and social power to try to boycott those who would defame them as arsonists. Interestingly, however, even though the Jews are not committing arson in any statistically significant way, the boycott fails. Why does it fail?
Well, it fails for a number of reasons. First of all, the fire insurance companies of America by that time are enormous, mostly located in New York and Connecticut. They're too big to take down. That's the first step. Second of all, the Jewish community ends up being divided on the issue as well. And of course, the lead culprit here is indeed Isaac Meir Weiss,
the founder of the Hebrewian College,
said it, who initially led the attack and called for boycotts. But then as New York leadership stepped forward, he withdrew. The other thing that I think backfired, unfortunately, from the Jewish community is the publicity. In other words, in 1867, what came to notice, especially of the Jews in Cincinnati, was that a number of the fire insurance companies were reluctant to insure Jews as fire risks. And the reason for this had much more to do with the peripatetic nature of Jewish life at that point, especially as peddlers and even as petty shopkeepers who were moving from one small town to another before finally settling in the larger cities. For the insurance companies based on the East Coast, as America opens up and they send their agents out across America, they know less and less about the people that they're insuring. So they come with some quick checklists of what to look for. And one of the things you look for are longtime inhabitants of towns. They have a stake. They have a stake. Everyone knows them. Their neighbors know them. They have a reputation. But when it came to Jews who are here today, gone tomorrow, in so many of these small towns, the insurance company decided they weren't insurable. There were risks. And what crops up actually in the insurance industry is a name for this. They call it Jew risks, referring not just to Jews, but to anyone who's unsettled and walking. All right. So a number of insurance companies decide they're not going to insure the Jews anymore for this. Now you have the Jewish protests. It makes all the papers. This becomes national news. Whereas before, this is an episode between a few fire insurance companies and the Jewish community. Now it becomes news across America. And now everyone decides to weigh in. There are sermons given about it by Jewish ministers. And for the most part, people proclaim, why are we picking on the Jews? And to deny insurance based on religion is not American. But by the time the episode finally cools down, all America knows the charges against the Jews of being arsonists have been offered. And that doesn't go away.
It's a little bit like the dilemma you faced in writing the book of addressing a problem and naming it and giving it a little bit too much dimensionality than perhaps you feel comfortable.
Yes.
What are the extraneous factors that are not ethnic, but that evolve in the United States that affect arson? I'm thinking of things such as architecture and the growing height of buildings, urban density, industrial products and their combustibility, and in the conceptual realm, advances in actuarial science.
In addition, you also have changes in firefighting. Before, it was all in private hands. Now we have a public fire department. Fire alarms are installed practically on every block. It means the fire engines can get to the scene faster. Eventually, you'll have the replacement of horse-drawn engines by motorized vehicles. And you'll have the establishment of all sorts of fire investigative bureaus, not only in New York, but other cities of America, that are quick to respond to what seems to be suspicious fires. As a result, the number of arson arrests go up. At first. And of course, you know, the other extraneous factor in that, now I'm going to what eventually leads to a diminishment of Jewish involvement in arson, is you have a rise in Jewish economic levels.
And also in society, do we find that the economics of arson society-wide also?
Always. There's an absolute link between the economic health of the country and the number of arson activities.
In characteristic style of Jeffrey Marks, you capture some of the great color of this history, not just the deeper sociological and historical truths and nuances. Tell us about some of these characters that are just captivating. Start, if you would, with Isaac Zucker and give us a little bit of a feel of these people.
Isaac Zucker gets the first big press as the Jewish arsonist. His picture is smeared all over the front pages. It's said that he's in charge of a huge gang, and they're busy burning down not apartments, but businesses in New York and Philadelphia and New Jersey. And it will turn out, of course, that he's actually just a busy bunny. So. He has his own private torch that he uses, Jacob Schoenholtz. And together, indeed, they burn down various businesses that Zucker owns. One fire, he said, at one of his places that he came before the insurance company arrived, didn't think enough damage had been done, and so took a poker and started pulling down pieces of the inside of the building, so it looked even worse. My favorite, though, of all of them is Sam Milch. He was a public adjuster, and in the end, he gets caught. And what does he do? He rats out everyone in the team that was involved. He avoids prison, and he stops being involved in the field of fire insurance, arson, all that. Instead, he goes into life insurance. Sam decides what he's going to do is he finds people that are really sick on death's door. He gets a doctor to certify that they're as healthy as Kirby. Oh, right. He takes out insurance on their life and then collects on. That's my favorite guy.
Let's talk about signifier and code, something every cultural minority experiences internally and externally. We know that anti-Semitism, like most types of bigotry, actually represents deeper currents of human frailty and deeper negotiations between different groups. What does the Jew as arsonist signify to non-Jewish America in the early 20th century?
Well, I think overall, we have to again remember how terrible and dangerous fire was 100 years ago. There were very difficult struggles when fires broke out, especially in crowded city streets. We have reports from the fire department about the fire started on an X building, jumped to the building next door, jumped to the building behind, and before you know it, you have an entire block that's raging. Fire machinery at first was hand-pumped, then steam-pumped. It took quite a while for firefighting capabilities to really improve. As a result, fire represented a terrible, terrible destructive force. And here you have the Jews are wielding it, right? Deliberately setting it. And this really, I think, underscores some of that deeper anti-Semitic myth. First of all, as the Jews as malevolent. In their race for money, in their greed, they don't care who they destroy. And that's a very old anti-Semitic trope that's going on. So the Jew as arsonist is not just this little quaint, how like the Jews to set their own buildings on fire. It's this is threatening to the rest of us.
drawing on that deep current, going back to antiquity.
Absolutely. The Jew is as other, right? The Jew is other. By the time I finished the work on this book, I had a little more, how should I put it, unhealthy appreciation of how deeply ingrained anti-Semitism has been in the U.S. since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, how it continues. It sort of, from my point of view, simmers beneath the surface and sometimes fires up.
As they say, it's a light sleeper, anti-Semitism.
Right.
Take us out from this interview with an anecdote or something you learned that surprised you most in writing this book.
I think what surprised me most, that the tenement owners were setting their own apartments on fire. That was startling. And it took me a while to figure out why would they do that and how dangerous, until I finally read enough about how the torches operate to understand this was a very, if you'll pardon the expression, a careful business was going on.
Well, Rabbi Jeffrey Marks, my friend, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on the College Commons podcast and this delightful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.